If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema, all lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
We're all for one, and one for all, some for each, or none for all. There'll be laughs and fun for all. That's how it's gonna.
That's how it's gonna be. Us for you,
or vice versa.
Rob a bank,
or snatch a purse.
You're the boss.
Now that's a good choice.
That's how it's gonna. That's how it's gonna be.
What's mine is yours.
What's mine is yours.
What's yours is mine.
What's yours is mine.
Whatever we got, the better of it. I'll tell you what, we'll cut it down the line.
From now on, whatever comes always pounds and always chumps.
But out with creeps and down with crumbs.
That's how it's gonna, that's how it's gonna be.
That, of course, was Peter Falk from Robin and the Seven Hoods. Unfortunately, Peter Falk died yesterday, so I just thought I'd throw that in as a little bit of a tribute to the guy. Did some fantastic work in cinema as well as television. People remember him for Columbo, but he also did a lot of other things as well, particularly Wings of Desire, so the Wim Wenders film. So check out some Peter Falk as a little bit of a tribute if you're so inclined to do so. Hi, this is Terry Frost, and this is Paleo Cinema Podcast 79, the Alphabet Project E's. So there were lots of people who gave me suggestions for E films, and I rejected them all and just kind of went my own way with it. But how are you? We're doing pretty good here. The solstice has happened, which means that we're turning towards summer, so I've got to take a little bit of consolation for that. And I did go to Continuum 7, the regional science fiction convention here in Melbourne, which happens every year, and there are a lot of good people there. I got to meet two of the guys from Box Cutters podcast, being John Richard and Josh Canal, and they are lovely people to meet. I really got on with them really well. I really like them. And we were talking about podcasting on a couple of panels. I did a panel about French science fiction cinema as well. And I did some improvised comedy sketches for some reason. I'm not entirely sure why. It was late at night, and I was doing it as a favour for a friend. But anyway, yeah, had a great time there, caught up with a lot of people, handed out some DVDs with all of Paleo Cinema on them, just to give people a bit of an idea about what I do and how I do it. And it was quite refreshing, very exhausting, because it was a long weekend. I started Friday night and didn't leave there till Monday afternoon. Well, I was commuting from home, but I was basically spending my whole time there. And yeah, it was very, very cool. And so that's what I've been doing. I also did something that I've been meaning to do for a while. It's on the Paleo Cinema list of things to do, which doesn't seem to ever get very much smaller. And that in particular was I got paleo-cinema.com. I own that domain name. So if you go into your little browser, and I hope it's not something like Internet Explorer, but go into your browser anyway, and if you type in paleo-cinema.com, it will redirect you to the Paleo Cinema blog. So I've got that going for me at the moment, and it didn't cost me very much at all, so I'm quite pleased with that. I've got 2 years on that, and I'm going to renew it and kind of brand the podcast just that little bit better, I hope. A couple of other things I've got going on. I've got some people lined up to be guests on Paleo Cinema podcast. Now, I've got to get my ass together and, well, not my ass, but the shit that comes out of it together, and get that organised. It's going to be separate from the A to Z project. I'll be honest with you about that. It's not going to be a continuation of that. They're going to be special episodes interspersed between the A to Z, which extends, of course, the A to Z project out. I have some cronies here in Melbourne that I'm going to do some FaceTime with and do a bit of a side-by-side recording of the podcast with them. And I have also lined up a couple of people with whom I am going to Skype in episodes. Now, I do have recording software that'll do that now. I've talked to a few people who already do it and got their best advice on which software to use, and I think I've got it nailed down there. So expect a few changes there. They're still going to be the solo episodes because getting people lined up every 2 weeks to be on the things a little bit beyond my organisational abilities, which are at best rudimentary. But yeah, so big things happening. I did say this year I wanted to get guests on, and I will get Sal back as well because her little content last time was very popular with the punters, so we're going to go with that as well. So on to, well, I'll tell you what, I'll do a little bit of a thing here and then I'll come back and tell you what I've been watching. That is a bit of music from the soundtrack to a computer game, believe it or not, called L.A. Noire. That's the opening title theme to that particular computer game. And with the fact that computer games are making more money these days than movies, the production values are just skyrocketing. And that's some very, very cool music coming out there in support of a computer game. And a lot of the coding and a lot of the brains for the computer game itself were, in spite of the fact that it's called L.A. Noire, Australian. It was produced by an Australian studio. So there you go. We're moving along in kind of weird directions. So what have I been watching? I'll go backwards. I did see a German film called The Spear of Destiny, which is quite a recent film. It's only been produced in the last couple of years, and it was subtitled, showing on World Movies, our foreign language film channel on cable here in Australia. And I like it. It's kind of a mashup between Indiana Jones and the Da Vinci Code and National Treasure. It's got little bits of all of that, where a bunch of good guys and bad guys are trying to find the spear of Longinus, the spear that stabbed Jesus in the kidneys during the crucifixion, and is supposed to give fantastic power to whoever owns it. And Goethe's involved. Goethe hid the spear of Longinus, apparently, and has set all these traps and puzzles for people to find it again. And it's quite good fun. It's a little bit different. It's got some nice location shots and some good action scenes that aren't all chopped to pieces the way modern action scenes often are. And yeah, worth checking out if you can find a copy of it. It's an interesting little piece of cinema and just that little bit different. This week for ABC Local Radio in Darwin, I talked about Spartacus, so I rewatched all 3 hours and 20 minutes of the 1960 Stanley Kubrick directed Kirk Douglas starring Woody Strode Rock's Spartacus. And yes, I enjoyed it a lot. I really liked the fact that in 1960, after they came through all of the biblical epics of the 50s, they went and made a kind of secular movie about just before the time of Christ in the Roman Empire. There wasn't all that Christianity stuff mixed in with it, and I do like that. I do like the, there's some great montage sequences as the slave army is travelling across Italy, and there's some great dialogue between particularly Peter Ustinov, Sir Laurence Olivier, and of course Charles Laughton in the Roman Senate, and particularly Ustinov and Laughton are marvellous in that film. And then, of course, you've got Kirk Douglas playing Spartacus and that fantastic gladiator scene with Woody Strode, which anybody who ever attempts to do an action film should learn from and take the lessons from. It's a fantastic piece of direction, and the build-up inside the box when they're waiting for their turn to go into fight in the gladiator pit is just fantastic. You need that build-up in an action scene. You don't just go flat chat into an action scene. The build-up is sometimes at least as important as the action itself, and particularly in this case. And it's a fantastic little object lesson for people who make cinema, and a kind of textbook for those of us who watch action cinema and like it, on how you differentiate between good and kind of overproduced and over-edited rubbish. And this is definitely the case. If they can do that in 1960, imagine how a good director can take things now. So there you go. I've watched that. And by the way, from now on the radio gig, I'm actually pre-recording a day early inside ABC Studios here in Melbourne down at Southbank. So I go into a little sound booth, which is called a TARDIS box. So I get to go into a TARDIS every week. And I'll be recording with Ivor then, and he'll just play it a night later when we do that. So about 6 p.m. on Wednesday nights, I'm at Southbank Studios talking movies and having a great time then. And this, of course, brings up a dilemma for me as well. The potential of me actually listening to myself on the radio, which I don't do when I'm recording it. If I'm talking to Ivor live on the radio, I don't listen to it. I'm just having a conversation there and really kind of can't look at it as a third person. But this leaves me with the possibility of doing that. And while I'm tempted, I'm also daunted by that possibility. It's a weird thing, but there you have it. Okay, what else have I been watching? Of course, I watched the movies for this one. I did see a terrific documentary, which I highly recommend to all of you guys. And that is Cameraman, the Life and Work of Jack Cardiff. Now, Jack Cardiff, of course, worked with Palin Pressburger on things like Matter of Life and Death and Black Narcissus, and went on to have an incredibly long career as both a cinematographer and as a director. And it's a great documentary on the history of Cardiff himself. And it's one of those documentaries about cinema where you need a notepad, because you're going to write things down that you've forgotten about or you haven't quite known about, and that look really, really cool when they show clips of them and of Jack Cardiff talking about them himself. So if you can get a hold of that one, and you may have to kind of go subterranean to get a copy of it, I recommend that you do if you are interested in cinema, because it really, really is worthwhile. And it's one of those kind of joyous celebrations of a man's life and career, and the fact that apart from being a cinematographer and a director, the man was a fine artist as well. So I enjoyed that. I did see the full version of Machete Maidens Unleashed, the version of it shown on Australian television, and from which a whole bunch of torrents and other copies of it were ripped. Runs about 55-56 minutes. The full version runs closer to about 124 to 125 minutes, and it does flesh things out, and it's not just padding, the extra stuff. It really is the full documentary, and well worth picking it up on DVD if you can. I know that Umbrella Entertainment have released it, so if you go to umbrellaent.com.au, you should be able to pick up a copy wherever you are. And it's great. And it comes in a two-disc set with one of the movies talked about in the film, The Mothers, M-U-T-H-E-R-S, as well as a whole bunch of extra material, extended interviews with people like Chris Mitchum and Paul Coslow, and people like that who are interviewed in the documentary itself. So it's worth picking up the extra stuff. Now, what else have I been watching? I did see Reservoir Dogs, because the week before I talked about Reservoir Dogs on the radio as well, and I enjoyed it again. You could see the start of Tarantino's love of dialogue and him conveying action with dialogue. And yes, it's a bloodfest, and yes, it was influenced by Ringo Lam's City on Fire, but the dialogue and the way that Tarantino approached it and moshed together a few different films that preceded it as well, to be honest with you, really does take it out of that claim of plagiarism. I don't think it really is. I think he's been influenced strongly by a few different films, but his own strengths have come into it, and you can see the start of that ramping up tension through dialogue that's so really apparent, particularly in the first scene of something like Inglourious Basterds. You can really see that in Reservoir Dogs rewatching it. I rewatched it on Blu-ray because I'm trying to get all of Tarantino on Blu-ray at the moment. And it rocked my socks all over again, so that was good fun. I did see the Tony Awards. I always like watching the Tony Awards, which is a fantastic thing. I wish I could see a whole bunch of the stage plays that are shown on there. But the Tony Awards really were fun. I did see, again, the first movie my mother ever took me to in the cinema back in the early 60s, which was called Move Over Darling, with Doris Day and James Garner. And it's got Thelma Ritter in it as well. And that was kind of okay. It's kind of one of those early 1960s sex comedy kind of things, which, it's almost like everybody is kind of sexually retarded in this particular film. And it was originally going to be a project for Dean Martin and Marilyn Monroe, but the illnesses that eventually led to her suicide and things like that prevented that from going ahead. And it was recast using a lot of the same sets as a Doris Day James Garner vehicle. And it's kind of light fluff, but it's got an interesting history because of that association to do Marilyn Monroe. And I'm actually giving my mum a copy of that as a little bit of a gift to her. One of the other things I did see, which is interesting, a 1942 kind of comedy pseudo-documentary called The Big Blockade, which stars just about everybody in English cinema at the time. And it's a kind of comedy documentary about the Ministry of Economic Warfare during World War II and how they kind of blocked supplies getting to the Axis powers during the war. And an interesting little thing, and it just shows how fucking sneaky the Brits were in the way they approached warfare. They couldn't outgun the Germans, but what they did do was kind of block supplies of rubber and other things like that to them in order to weaken them in a lot of cases. So, yeah, that was interesting. Let me see. I did see X-Men First Class. Did I talk about that? Yeah, I think I did. But, I've seen a few other things, but nothing that really jumps out at me. I did see Get Him to the Greek, which was kind of okay. Has a couple of moments in it. But, I'm not too keen on most of Judd Apatow's stuff. I do like some modern comedies. I mean, Step Brothers is fantastic. And I'm going to play a clip from Step Brothers at some stage during your podcast sooner or later, just to show how funny it is. But that's about it. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now that I've gone about 19 minutes without talking about any of the two films that I'm going to be talking about, which of course are The Iger Sanction, starring Clint Eastwood, and Your Son Visage, also known as Eyes Without a Face, the Georges Franju French horror film from 1960. I'll be back in a bit and we'll get on with that.
When it's spring again, I'll bring again tulips from Amsterdam. With a heart that's true, I'll give to you tulips from Amsterdam. I can't wait until the day you fill these eager arms of mine. Like the windmill keeps on turning, That's how my heart keeps on yearning for the day I know we can share these tulips from Amsterdam. Spring again, oh, I'll bring again tulips from Amsterdam. With a heart that's true, I'll give to you tulips from Amsterdam. I can't wait until the day you fill these eager arms of mine. Like the windmill keeps on turning, that's how my heart keeps on yearning for the day I know we can share these tulips from Amsterdam, share these tulips from Amsterdam.
That was Max Bygraves singing Tulips from Amsterdam. I ripped that one off vinyl myself. I've now got myself a turntable with a USB port attached to it, and it lets me rip my old albums onto MP3, which means, of course, that here in the studio cum library, I'm now surrounded by licorice pizza, waiting to be turned into digital form. So, yeah, a bit of a chaotic thing around here at the moment. So let's talk about The Iger Sanction. It's based on a 1972 novel by Trevanian, which was actually a guy called... The guy's name was... Rodney William Whittaker. He was an American film scholar and writer. He wrote under the pen name of Trevanian. Did a few good novels. His novel, particularly the one, his novel Shibumi, is excellent, and I do recommend it if you can find a copy of it. But basically, The Iger Sanction was written by Whittaker as a piss take on James Bond type films, James Bond type characters and James Bond type novels and films and things like that. Of course, Whittaker being a film scholar. It was a total pastiche. It had an unlikable protagonist who was a selfish asshole and really an incredible snob as well. So you can see where the satire part comes in. So 1972, Hollywood buys the rights to this. Nobody in Hollywood picks that it's a spoof. It's a satire on the spy genre. And because of this, of course, Whittaker went on to do a second novel called The Lewes Sanction, starring the same character, the one that Clint Eastwood plays in this film, a guy called Jonathan Hemlock. So Whittaker writes a second one, which is even wilder spoof, and is actually a good, fun novel to read. If you can get a copy of The Iger Sanction and The Lewes Sanction in book form, they're much, much more interesting than the movie, which isn't to say the movie isn't interesting. I'll just give you a bit of a précis about it and a bit of an idea about who's in it. It was directed by Clint Eastwood as well, which is a mixed blessing at times, in particular in relationship to this film. Let's see what we've got. Dr. Jonathan Hemlock, Professor of Arts and the Mountaineer, is a retired government assassin called on to return to work for two more sanctions, in quotes, a euphemism for officially approved killings. He has used the fortune made on the previous sanctions to amass 21 rare masterpiece paintings, primarily stolen pieces, smuggled into the US from Europe. The director of the secret government agency called C2 is Mr. Dragon, an albino ex-Nazi confined to semi-darkness and kept alive by blood transfusions. Dragon wants Hemlock to kill two men responsible for the death of another government agent. And, of course, at least one of the men is on a mountain climb onto the Iger, hence the Iger sanction. And Hemlock goes back into training as a mountaineer with his old pal, a guy called Ben Bowman, played by George Kennedy. His contact with C2 is an agent called Jemima, played by Vanetta McGee. And it runs from there. And there's a lot of mountain climbing in Arizona as well as in the Eiger itself. And yeah, so as an action film, this kind of works. I think there are a couple of slow scenes towards the start, which kind of make it drag its ass a little bit. But the cast is quite interesting. You've got Eastwood and George Kennedy, Vonetta McGee, Jack Cassidy playing a gay spy called Miles Mellow, has a few interesting moments. Thayer David, who you might remember, played the villain in the Journey to the Center of the Earth, the one that had James Mason and Pat Boone in it. I saw the end of that recently on television, and I thought Thayer David was kind of interesting as the villain in that. Brenda Venus playing George, a mountain climber. Gregory Walcott is one of the other secret agents there. Gregory Walcott, you might remember, was the main protagonist in Plan 9 from Outer Space, and of course that 80s, 60s career very, very effectively. He's now a preacher. And Candice Realson, who you might remember from any number of Roger Corman exploitation films, including Chatterbox, which is a fantastic little remake of a French movie. And she plays an art student who is one of Dr. Hemlock's students and makes it pretty obvious near the start of the film that she'd be very interested in increasing her grades by lowering her knickers. So, So what's the problem with the film? A couple of things. I mean, it's one of those Hollywood vanity projects. Clint Eastwood was 44 at the time this film was made, and he wanted to, you know, do another film where he had a lot of physicality to it. So he's 44 years old. He gets to direct this thing. It's got a fair budget. He's got the cast he wants, people he likes working with for the most part. And one of the problems is that Eastwood insisted on doing his climbing and stunts, which made it very difficult. All the bits where you see Clint Eastwood and other people climbing around mountains, they were helicoptered in daily to do that. They didn't actually climb the mountains. There's a lot of Hollywood subterfuge involved in this for fairly obvious logistical reasons and probably insurance reasons at the time. There was a lot of insurance problems at the time itself. One of the other issues is one of the climbers during the filming of the film died. He died, you know, getting Clint Eastwood his shot, in a sense. And there were a number of other accidents. The guy who died was a 27-year-old English climber called David Knowles, who was a body double for one of the actors and was killed. And the guy running the climbing part of the film, a guy called Mike Hoover, who was an Academy Award-nominated professional mountaineer, almost died as well. There is a lot of information peripheral to the film, and I've done a little bit of research. I looked at a book called Clint Eastwood, American Rebel, which doesn't always get its facts right. But there were other accidents and events during the filming of this film which were covered up by the studio and the producers to kind of keep things going. The film was almost stopped from production because of the number of accidents and unfortunate incidents that occurred during the making of it. And a lot of it is there on the screen. There are some exciting climbing scenes there, and there's a great bit where Eastwood and George Kennedy are shown climbing. It looks like Monument Valley. Could well be Monument Valley. They're climbing a pinnacle in Monument Valley as a part of his training to get back into shape as a mountaineer. And, yeah, it's quite a nice scene. I remember at the time I liked the film a lot more than I liked it now. But I think one of the reasons is I can kind of see the cracks in the thing. I can see that the Clint Eastwood character, he's playing Dirty Harry as a secret agent mountaineer. He's got that kind of tight jaw thing. And he does that signature Clint Eastwood move. Now, anytime, if you ever see Clint Eastwood turn away from you slightly, look away for a moment, you know he's going to throw a punch at you. He's got this kind of signature move which he uses in any number of films. And he uses it two or three times in this movie where he kind of turns away as if to walk away from somebody he's just had a conversation with. And then suddenly turns and punches the guy. Now, if you ever see Clint Eastwood doing that for you, kick him in the back of the leading knee and he's going to collapse because basically he's telegraphing his move to anybody that's ever seen one of his movies. I'm just going to play a bit of the trailer for the Eiger Sanction now to give you a little bit of an idea about it. A lot of people know the film already and it's not necessary, but I'll just do a bit of it to kind of get you into the zeitgeist of this film as it was in 1975.
Clint Eastwood, the man. Tiger, the mountain. A deadly combination. Help! Sanction, a violation of the law to enforce the law.
One of our agents has been killed in Zurich by two men. We want you to sanction them.
Killing.
It is what you do best. The target is male. He is an accomplished mountain climber.
What's his name?
We don't know. We know which mountain he will climb. The Eiger.
From the suspenseful international bestseller, The Eiger Sanction. Every character brought vividly alive.
If you ever come near me again, I'm going to kill you.
Jonathan Hemlock, collector of art and women. Mountain climber. And expert at sanctions. Big Ben Bowman, how much did he really know?
Why the hell didn't he polish you off?
The raven-haired beauty, Jemima Brown.
For your information, I was not assigned to seduce you.
Dragon, head of search and sanction for C2.
I'm going to give you a bonus. Miles Mellow.
I didn't actually kill him, you know. Well, I probably won't actually kill you.
And George, the trainer.
She's a girl.
And unpredictable.
Is one of the other climbers, the Frenchman, the German, or the Austrian.
Doesn't bother you a bit that you've blown my cover, does it?
And now Montaigne is either hurt or he's dead. I knew that'd be death.
It was planned that way.
His lifeline in the hands of the assassin he hunted.
So you get the idea from that. I've got a bit more about the death of the climber during the film. They were doing a mountain, a bit of a mountain slide, a landslide kind of thing, recreated using rubber rocks. The two climbers, Hoover and Knowles, decided to shoot it themselves. They positioned on a low ledge to get the angle they wanted when suddenly the rubber rocks triggered real rocks and they all started falling at the same time. Possibly the vibrations from the helicopters created the landslide. Hoover suffered a broken pelvis and clung to the side of the mountain until rescuers could get to him. Knowles wasn't so lucky. He was found dead, hanging upside down, dangling from one foot, his head crushed by a boulder that had killed him instantly. That's from Clint Eastwood, American Rebel. Now, here's what Eastwood said about it. He kind of made an unofficial statement. It was a very difficult picture to make. Good thing our gadgets were limited in number. We were running the risk of heading in the direction of the James Bond movies. Especially the mountaineering sequences posed enormous problems. We had to shoot with two crews, one crew of technicians and one crew of mountain climbers. Every morning we had to decide, according to the weather report, which one to send up the mountain. The three actors and myself had to undergo intensive training. On the seventh day of filming, we lost one of the mountaineers, and believe me, I asked myself repeatedly if it was worth it. And, it's one of those things where, is it worth somebody's life to make a movie? It's an important question to ask. And there have been any number of films where people have died. Things like the original Flight of the Phoenix, one of the stunt crew died. I think one of the pilots of one of the planes died or something like that. And again, you know, it's one of those difficult things. Of course, this was incredibly played down during the promotion of the film, which it turned out was a flop. I think it did okay in Australia, as I recall, but it really wasn't all that popular. It got panned when it was released in May 75. A lot of people criticised Eastwood's performance in it because he was basically wrong for the role. I think Jonathan Hemlock's role was required somebody with a bit less teeth-gritting macho and a bit more kind of sophistication. He's a university professor and an art connoisseur as well as the other things he is. And he's a snob and he's a bit of an asshole and all that sort of thing, but he's not really the Clint Eastwood type of character. They were originally going to film it with Paul Newman when the studio first got the rights in 1972, but that kind of fell through and Newman didn't want to play it the way the character was written. But the things I take away from it that are positives are, I do like Vanetta McGee, and I think she holds her own against Clint Eastwood. I like Jack Cassidy as Miles, who's very kind of fey and effete, but essentially tough. I think there's been some kind of rejigging of part of the... I know, it's in the book. In the book, Miles' death is a little harsher than it is in the movie. Now, I'm not going to give do a spoiler on that and tell you what it is, but I think the movie lost an opportunity by going soft on that particular scene. So, yeah, it's and yeah, George Kennedy's a bit of fun in there. It's but Eastwood, I've got a problem with. I think late Eastwood as an old man is a much more interesting actor than Eastwood as a kind of younger and middle-aged man when he was playing the macho stuff. And there is some kind of political incorrectness in this film as well. I mean, when you're kissing a woman on a bed, you don't start making jokes about rape, but apparently Eastwood thought it was acceptable at the time, and there are a couple of points in that. And there is a little bit of homophobia in there, less than there might have been in some other films. But, I mean, the Miles Mellow character is, of course, set up as a villain, and you kind of come up against that question of, it's a truly kind of integrated minority group, be it black people or homosexuals or whatever, into society, in our fictions that we create, it should be okay to have them as negative characters, as long as all of them are portrayed as negative characters, because there are good gay people and bad gay people, just like there are good of any group or bad of any group, with the possible exception of Al-Qaeda. And yeah, when is it okay to have a negative person, you know, like an antagonist, as a minority character in a film or in any kind of work of art? And when is it okay? When do you have to kind of err on the side of positive to do that? It's a kind of ongoing dynamic, depending on where society is right at the time you're doing it as well. So, I did like the Miles character. He's kind of very suave, and he lightly flirts with the girls as if he's a heterosexual. But essentially, the big muscle guy he has as his bodyguard, there's a hint of a relationship between them. And, yeah, I'm not entirely comfortable with the way that the Miles character is treated in this film, but on the other hand, I'm also not entirely uncomfortable with it. It's a little bit of an odd thing there. We're right on the cusp of gay people being accepted as human beings and well-rounded and sane human beings. And you've got to remember, up until fairly historically recently, homosexuality was looked on as a mental illness. But I'll leave that for another podcast. What I was going to do, one of the things I want to do in a future podcast, is look at paleo cinema portrayals of gay characters in movies and just show how things, negative stereotypes evolved into the positive stereotypes to a certain extent that we have now. I've got a copy of Vita Russo's book, The Celluloid Closet. I'm going to go through that and kind of work on a gay-themed episode of Paleo Cinema. So that's sometime in the future. Anyway, so to summarise on the IGA sanction, the book's much better than the movie. The movie's got some good action sequences. There's a few different moments there, but I think the biggest problem with the film, essentially, is Clint Eastwood. So that's about it. I'm going to be back in a moment after another break, and we're going to talk about Your Sans Visage, Georges Franju's movie, also known as Eyes Without a Face, which is dead set 100% in the horror genre.
To a bowling alley, and things ain't what they used to be. There's Teds with drainpipe trousers and Debs in coffee houses, and things ain't what they used to be. There used to be trams, not very quick, got you from place to place, but now there's just jams, half a mile thick. Stay in the human race, I'm walking, they've stuck parking meters outside our doors to greet us. Now things ain't what they used to be. Oh, monkeys flying round the moon, we'll be up there with them soon. Things ain't what they used to be. Once
Our beer was frothy, but now it's frothy coffee. Well, things ain't what they used to be.
It used to be fun, dead old mum, paddling down South End, but now it ain't fun. Never mind, chum, Paris is where we spend our outings. Grandma tries to shock us all doing these up rock and roll things ain't what they used to be.
We used to have stars, singers who sung a Dixie Melody, they're buying guitars, clinkety-plonk, decking themselves with free chords only once. We dance from 12 to 3, I've got news for Elvis P.
Things ain't what they used to, it's the lot we used to. Things ain't what they used to be.
That was Max Bygraves again with Things Ain't What They Used To Be from a musical of the same name, written by Lionel Bart, who wrote the music for the movie Oliver. Yep, okay, let's talk about some Your Song Visage, Georges Franju's film Eyes Without a Face. I'll do a little bit of a précis from it, and then I'll explain something that Franju himself said about the film, which kind of put it all into real perspective for me and took this totally into a different headspace. Okay, here's the précis from IMDb. A surgeon feeling guilty over his daughter's facial disfigurement, so horrible that she wears a mask. No, that's a very bad one. Near Paris, the brilliant and famous surgeon, Dr. Genesier, destroyed the face of his beloved daughter, Christiane, in a car accident. He becomes insane trying to restore her face through successive transplants of the faces of pretty young women abducted by his assistant, Louise. That's a much better one. Yeah, so that's basically the situation of Your Song Visage, a 1960 film. It's gone by a few names. There's a really bad name that was used for the film in some countries. Let me see what I've got there. Just trying to find what the silly thing is. Yep, here it is. It was released in the US under the title of The Horrid Chamber of Dr. Faustus, which is kind of a generic horror name, isn't it, really? It was a double feature on with The Manster, so it shows how lame the US release of the film was. This film's been very influential, too. It's influenced John Carpenter, Jess Franco, and John Woo. And if you see the last scene of the film, you'll understand how it's influenced John Woo. The most striking scene, the most striking image from the film is the image of the daughter Christiane, played by an actress called Edith Scobb, with a kind of porcelain mask over her face. It's really kind of one of the striking images of all horror films. But one of the things that Franju himself said about the film was very interesting. He said it wasn't a film of horror. It's a film of anguish. Now, you've got the anguish of various characters. You've got the anguish of Dr. Genesier, played by Pierre Brasseur, over the fact that in a car accident he was driving in, his daughter's face was seriously disfigured. You got the anguish of his assistant and come girlfriend Louise, played by Alida Valli, and because she loves the man, helping him with this obsessive need to reconstruct the face of his daughter. And then, of course, you've got the most essential anguish, which is Christiane's, where she's had repeated operations on her face to have face transplants from the girls that Dr. Genesier has kidnapped and peeled the faces off. And in fact, the movie starts with Alida Valli playing the assistant, Louise, driving through the night on the outskirts of Paris with a kind of figure covered up with a coat and a hat, lurching around the back seat of her small car. And she eventually stops somewhere and dumps the body of a woman into a river. So it's a very kind of striking thing. Now, one of the themes of this is, of course, the title says it all, Eyes Without a Face, Your Song Visage. The eyes of various characters, Genesier's eyes behind his kind of thick glasses, Alida Valli, who was a striking actress and had lovely eyes, her eyes as she is driving through the night, and then, of course, Edith Scobb's eyes, which are the only, that and her body language are the only ways she can portray the absolute endless horror that she undergoes as that character, and the anguish. And it is very much a film of anguish. It's one of the really strikingly horrible films, and I mean horrible in the sense of horror, ever made. It really does. And part of it is that, is of course the skill that Franju himself brings to the film, and Edith Scobb. People have said she isn't much of an actress, but she's a great presence, and that's pretty much it. There are a couple of scenes that really kind of bring, well, three scenes really that bring that into play. There is a scene where Christiane finds one of the girls whom her father has strapped down and is about to peel the face off in order to transplant it onto her. And you see it from the viewpoint of the woman strapped to the gurney, and you know, she's just been drugged, so she can only see an out-of-focus image of a horrible face, being, of course, Christiane's face without the mask, looming over her while she's strapped down to the table. And it's a very effective scene, because there's a couple of little lights shining into the eyes of Christiane, which kind of give it a kind of manic glow, which is it's hard to describe, and I'm sorry if I'm describing it badly, but it really is one of the great scenes. And there's another scene as well where she's had her face transplanted, and she's Edith Scott, beautiful young lady at the time, 21 years old when the film was made, and she's having dinner with her father and Louise, and Louise points out that she's blushing slightly, and her father walks outside with Louise and tells her that the transplant isn't working, because it isn't quite a flush. It's the beginning of facial rot showing through the skin. And there's a really clinical series of still images of Christiane as the face rots on her, and her father doing a voiceover of his medical notes, just outlining the necrosis that's increasingly occurring to the face, and the fact that they're going to have to remove the transplant again in order to try again. And Genesier just repeatedly tries this until finally it becomes too much for both Louise and Christiane, and events do end in a kind of tragic epiphany in a weird kind of way. I'm going to play some music from the film just to kind of give you the mood of it. Now, it is hard to portray a film that's so strikingly visual than this on a podcast, but the music is by Maurice Jarret from the film, and this is the romantic theme from Eyes Without a Face, and it just kind of gives you a little bit of an idea of how important a film in the genre this really is.
Mon masque me fait plus peur encore.
Georges Franju is an interesting character too. He was one of the two people who created the Cinémathèque Française, the big French film institute, which is still going to this very day. It has one of the largest archives of films, movie documents, and film-related objects in the world. It's located in Paris, of course, and Franju and a friend of his started up when the movie magazine that they were working on kind of stopped production after two issues. The film magazine was called Le Cercle du Cinéma. And in 1936, Franju and a friend of his called, he said, Henri Langlois, created this. And in 1949, Franju began working on a series of 9 documentaries about things like the Nazi occupation of Paris and industrialism following World War II. And he did a film, Le Sang des Bêtes, which was filmed a day inside a Paris slaughterhouse to show people exactly where their food came from. And if you get the DVD version, the Australian DVD release of Eyes Without a Face, that particular documentary, which is very confronting, is an extra on the DVD itself. Now, one of the other films that I really like is his 1963 film, Judex, starring Channing Pollock, who was a stage magician. And it also has Edith Scob in it as well. And that film's very kind of interesting. It's kind of in that French masked villain kind of thing, the Fantomas Judex kind of theme. And again, it's visually striking. One of the hallmarks of Franju's cinema is that striking visual style, which is where a lot of the influences on people like John Woo come from. You can't really mistake a Franju film for a run-of-the-mill piece of work. It really does have an essential strength to it. And but this film, this is, as Franju said, it's a film of anguish. But it's one of those films that stays in your memory as well. Just the images of it and the enormous, monumental sadness of the Christiane character really does have an emotional impact on it. And John Carpenter said that the film inspired the idea of a featureless mask for Michael Myers in the Halloween series, for instance. And it's just a lovely, horrible film. And there is a very confronting scene as well where they the surgery of peeling the face off one of the victims of Dr. Genesier is shown in surprising detail for the time. I'm sure this was cut from a lot of the prints at the time, but it's been restored for the modern print. And just when he kind of gets the texture colour pen and draws where the surgery is going to take place on a woman's face and then works at her with a scalpel in doing so in a very kind of clinical, medical way. And the kind of medical objectivity of what he's doing really adds to the horror of it as well. That kind of, you know, focus, absence of care really does freak me out a bit when I watch it. I always kind of grip my teeth and just kind of find it a difficult scene to watch because of that. And it's not anywhere near as graphic or as kind of ugly as a lot of torture porn, but in its own way, it's very, very, very strong stuff, particularly for the time it was in. And the weird thing is you've got this kind of hideous surgical stuff along with a few scenes of incredible beauty and gentleness and almost wonder. And matching those stylistically, it's seamless. And matching that kind of objective medical procedure thing against the beauty part of it is a hell of an achievement, and very much to Franju's credit that he did it. If you haven't seen this film and you are interested in horror films, I really do recommend that you do. It should be available pretty widely out there. I believe a Criterion edition has been released from it, and they tend to do the better stuff. And this film really does belong in anyone's collections. I'm not an enormous horror fan myself, but I find this film hypnotic and mesmerizing and very, very important. It's one of those kind of nice things about diving into the films of a non-English speaking culture, finding these things which have influenced other people but in their own right really do bring something new to a genre which from a lot of viewpoints is kind of tapping itself out in an orgy of blood, guts, and torture. So that's about it for that one. I'm going to take another break now. And after that, there's feedback. There's a fair bit of feedback, and we'll get into that.
Listen, I'm sick of being all coy and bashful, Dale.
Okay.
We're in the bathroom.
This'll just take a minute. You're really little you can do about it.
Alice.
Let me just hop.
Ah!
Oh!
It's all slippery.
Ah! Ah! Oh! Oh my God!
Getting tingly! Something's gonna happen, huh?
Oh, we just had sex. Just the way I imagined it.
I like you.
I love you. Stay golden, pony boy.
Okay.
I gotta pee.
Oh my God. You're incredible.
I love Step Brothers. It's my favorite comedy of recent years. And I like that scene. On to the feedback now. I did get one from Rob Kelly, an email saying, Terry, another great show. Duck Soup and DOA were both films I first saw on cable and got immediately drawn into for very different reasons, of course. I've always had a hard time with the Marx Brothers. I find the films interminable with their god-awful romantic subplots and musical numbers. Truth be told, I never found Chico or Harpo funny either, but I love Groucho so much that it was worth sitting through any one of their films just to see him. The first time I ever saw Groucho was in a scene in a restaurant with Groucho romancing a young lady. A waiter comes by and hands Groucho the check. He takes a look at it and exclaims, $15? Why, that's outrageous. Turning to his date, he drops the check in her lap and says, if I were you, I wouldn't pay it. I remember roaring at that line. It was so fresh and unexpected to this Marx Brothers neophyte. I've been a Groucho admirer ever since. Anyway, great show. I'm really enjoying the A to Z project. Take care, Rob Kelly. P.S. Just FYI, I was 11 when I saw E.T. on first run and I didn't think it was all that big a deal. Still don't. Thanks for that, Rob. I agree. It's interesting. People take different things from the Marx Brothers depending on who they are and what they like. I find the dialogue really snappy. I think that the people they got to write from, including, as I said last time, S.J. Perelman, amongst others, really did have that beautiful love of playing with words and turning words and sentences and the way we use language and the preconceptions of society into a game. And I really do like that part of the Marx Brothers. And, of course, a lot of that does come down to Groucho. So thanks for that one. Anyway, let's get on with the first of the voicemails as well. Oh, by the way, Rob, I'm glad you like the A to Z project. I do think that it gives me a bit of guidance on what I'm going to do with the podcast. And it kind of takes me on a nice little trip while I'm doing it. But anyway, on to the first of the voicemails.
Paleo Cinema. There's... It's Dr. Zom. Paleo Cinema. Watched a couple of movies I wanted to just talk about, bring to your attention, as Paleo Cinema is the place to go for classic movies, classic movie reviews, and classic Terry Frost. Anyway, I digress. The first movie is called Scarlet Street, 1945. The movie is directed by the legendary film director Fritz Lang. This movie stars Edward G. Robinson, and I've got to be honest with you, since I got my HD box and I started getting Turner Classic Movies, I've seen Edward G. Robinson in quite a few movies, and he's always been, an icon. I knew of him, and I had seen probably a couple of movies that he was in, but, he's got so many, and I'm getting to watch a lot of them, and I'm beginning to really enjoy and develop an appreciation for E.G.R., Edward G. Robinson. This movie also stars Joan Bennett and Dan Duryea. I like it. It's a very good noir movie. Edward G. Robinson, usually when you first think of him, you think of him in gangster roles. But in this movie, he kind of goes the opposite way because he is what they would call in the con game, the mark. He works as a cashier in a, a big bank, and they have a big banquet for him. His boss and all his cronies are there, and they're all dressed up in tuxedos and everything, and they're drinking champagne and having a nice, formal dinner. And the owner of the bank, to show his appreciation for all the years that Edward G. Robinson has served them loyally, gives them this really super duper nice gold watch that's inscribed, saying how great he is and what a part of the team he is and everything. Well, then when the bank manager leaves, he's an older guy. He goes down to get in his big fancy luxury car with a chauffeur and everything, and he's got like a 20-year-old hottie waiting for him in the car, and it's not his wife. So they're all looking out the window and thinking, oh my God, whoo, what I wouldn't do to be in his place and to have somebody like that. But so anyway, he starts, Edward G. Robinson, he's married and he's kind of a schlub and he stays at home with his wife and he likes to paint and he's, kind of got a simple life and everything, but it gets the juices flowing, gets those juices just boiling, to the top. And he sees a girl getting accosted by a guy, smacked around, if you will, on the street, and he saves her. Well, so automatically she's a younger chick, Joan Bennett, and he starts thinking, hey, and so he starts kind of trying to develop a little relationship on the side. Little does he know that she and the guy that was smacking her around are, let's just say, a nefarious nature, and they start looking at Edward G. Robinson as a mark and how they're going to take him for a ride, if you will, baby. So anyway, it's a good movie. I don't want to give away. That's just the basic plot there, but I liked it, and it's pretty tight. And Fritz Lang, yeah, like it. I'm going to watch some more Fritz Lang, and I'm also going to definitely watch some more Edward G. Robinson, because there's a lot out there to look at. The other movie that I wanted to just bring up briefly is a movie that that kind of eluded a lot of people for years, because I think it was out of print, or if it ever was on VHS, I don't think it was for the longest time, or on DVD, and it just came out, and they actually have a Blu-ray of it, I believe, also, that just came out. But I watched it in HD the other night, and that is the Steve McQueen 1971 movie Le Mans. And let me tell you something, I've read two biographies of McQueen. And, they talk a lot about this movie. This was a passion project for him, because he was really into racing motorcycles and cars. And so anyway, I'd always heard that this movie was, when he shot it, it just took forever. And he shot so much footage of the actual, car race and everything, that it kind of came across more like a documentary. And he didn't know what to do, if he wanted to make it a drama or a documentary. Well, watching it, I will say this. He could have made one hell of a documentary out of it. I'm not super duper into auto racing, but this is like a time capsule, 1971, the cars and everything. But not only did he shoot the race, but he shot the event, which is Le Mans, and all the the people, the fanfare, all the little sideshow kind of things that they have. It's almost like a carnival, a great big giant carnival with all these people coming from everywhere, international cast and everything. They did, I think John Sturgis started out as the director of this, and he and McQueen kind of butted heads, and he got pulled from the flick. The movie ended up, the credit for the directing credit ended up going to Lee Katzen. And I think this is about the only feature film that he did, just major Hollywood feature film, because he spent almost all his entire career, if not all of his entire career, doing TV. But this movie's good. They do have a little bit of a dramatic story in it, but it's kind of, kept to a minimum, and it's very subtle, and it works in that way. I thought, from all I had read and everything, that I wasn't sure if I would like it or not. I really did like it, and I watched it on cable on HD, and I'm going to go out and pick up the DVD or the Blu-ray or whatever I can get my hands on, because I really enjoyed watching it that much and watching the spectacle that is Le Mans. And also, Steve McQueen, the guy was just awesome. His subtle thing, the things that he did and everything. A true icon, if you will, baby. Anyway, this is Dr. Zom. I'm going to keep it to that for this week. I'm going to be going on vacation here coming up shortly. So I just wanted to say to all my friends all over the world, including Australia, this is Dr. Zom, saying Dr. Zom, Zom out.
Yeah, thanks, Zom. It's interesting that when you said Australia there, mate, you sounded even more southern than you usually do. But anyway, Scarlet Street and Lamont, I'm adding him to my list. I haven't seen either of them in a very long time, and I did like Scarlet Street. I think Edgar G. Robinson got away from his gangster stereotype really effectively in that film and showed a bit more depth. One of the things I know about Robinson that was very interesting is he's a fantastic collector of art. And a very intelligent, sophisticated man playing against some of the types of characters he was in, he played in movies. And, yeah, Fritz Lang, I've really got to kind of do a big session of early Fritz Lang stuff, things like Ministry of Fear and Scarlet Street and all those kind of things that he did when he first came to Hollywood, because I find them very interesting films. And I've got to get back and see some more and watch his Dr. Mabuse films. I've got them. But I haven't really had time to watch them as well. But thanks for that, Zom. It's always good having you on there. And we will have you as a guest on the podcast as well. I will announce that now. As soon as you and I can arrange it, my people talk to your people, we'll get that done. And I think we've picked the movies that we're going to do, and they're not going to be typical films for us, really. Anyway, on to the next voicemail.
Hey, Terry, this is Richard from Wichita. Take two. Sorry, I lost the first call. Bad area. It's a bad service area. So if this call gets lost again, I will just call in another day. But I wanted to let you know that I'm playing some catch-up on Paleo Cinema. Still listening, still loving the show. Just got a little bit behind. Work's gotten a little bit crazier. A lot more conference calls, unfortunately, so a little less time to listen to podcasts. And I was down for a couple of weeks with shoulder surgery, so I didn't listen to the podcast during that period of time. But I did watch a lot of movies. Now, playing some catch-up on the Paleo Cinema right now, on my way to Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm going to spend some time with my folks, doing my annual June trek to Trek Expo. And I know that I left a message with you last year, I believe, when I drove down here, so... hopefully this message, I can get everything out in this message, but again, if I lose it, I will call back later. But I wanted to share with you that I watched a lot of movies while I was down for 2 weeks, and I kind of tried to stir things up. I mean, I watched some Vincent Price and Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, and I watched some Akira Kurosawa, but what I started off was I did a five-film Memorial Day marathon, and all five films are very, very different. Now, I started off with All Quiet on the Western Front, the original 1930 version. This is a movie I've seen three times, but it's been more than 20 years since I've seen it the last time. I know that the first time I saw it was in 1987, working at Wichita State University. I was going to college. I was working at the Media Resource Center, and one of the jobs I had was to be the projectionist for a World War I history class. Saw a lot of great movies, and this was one of the films that I watched. I really enjoyed this movie, but it's not something I can just go to and watch, you know, over and over again. It's pretty grim at times, a little comical, you know. Some of it hasn't aged very well, but all in all, a really good film and one that I would highly recommend. Just be aware that it does get a little bit political, a little preachy, and it's an old movie, so you just have to be prepared for that. But it's got, I think, a really good message. I think it is a really good film. It's a classic. The next one I watched was part of a four-film set I got from Turner Classic Movies on World War II Europe. And the first was Battleground with, I believe, Van Johnson. I'd seen part of this about a year ago, really enjoyed it. It's very typical of the day. It's a 1949 film, so it's got that very much World War II Hollywood feel to it. A little light on story and, you know, a little heavier on character. But I really enjoyed it. If you love movies from that day, if you love, you know, like Sands of Iwo Jima and stuff like that, I'd recommend Battleground. Got some interesting cast, James Whitmore, a very young Ricardo Montalban. So again, I'd highly recommend it. The next one I watched was Kelly's Heroes. Now, it's been a long time since I'd seen Kelly's Heroes, and a couple of things really stood out to me. I watched it with a more critical eye this time, and, you know, there's the two things that really kind of take me out of the moment and kind of bothered me with this movie. One was the music. It's very, you know, late 1960s, early 70s. It doesn't feel like World War II at all. I can't, you know, it's a very... strong, I don't want to say hippie song, but that's kind of what it felt like when I listened to it. It just seemed so out of place. Donald Sutherland, I love his character in the movie. He's hilarious, but he's not playing a character from, you know, 1945. He's more apt to be a Vietnam soldier than a World War II soldier, and that kind of bothered me a little bit. Again, I enjoyed his character, but it took me out of the moment. Now, I love Kelly's Heroes, but you go into it, you really have to have that mindset that you're just going to have fun and not get as picky as I was finding myself. I did laugh when Clint Eastwood has the showdown with the tank and the little riff of the spinoff or, you know, music of The Good, the Bad, the Ugly's playing. I'm sure it got a huge laugh at the time. And now I just kind of, you know, I kind of groaned a little bit. Like, really? They went there? It was funny, but I'd still recommend it. It's a very funny film. It's a good film. Got some good action sequences in it. But I found my next film to be much better, and that's The Dirty Dozen. Again, a very long time since I've seen this. Illy Marvin is just classic in this movie. And this one I found, again, a lot of great action sequences, a lot of location shooting, and I really felt like they really paid respect to the era. And I felt, you know, both of these movies, more so Dirty Dozen, just felt like a guy's film, you know. It's just like guys on the sets and out there just doing what they're doing. Just, I found it to be really, really enjoyable. The one movie that I didn't find enjoyable was Where Eagles Dare. Now, I'd never seen this one before, and I really could not recommend it. I'm not a big fan of Richard Burton, and I felt like this is not Clint Eastwood's best. And the biggest problem I had with this movie, other than the fact it just kind of felt like it went on and on and on, was the fact that a lot of the battle sequences or location shooting or the chase sequences are not filmed on location. They're very clearly filmed on a soundstage, and I'm sure that's mostly because of Richard Burton. It may be entirely Richard Burton. To me, it just really detracted from the film and was disappointing that they did that, and really played a big part in why I just didn't enjoy the film. I would not go back and revisit Where Eagles Dare, whereas all the other four films I would go back and revisit. So, kind of curious if you've seen any of those. I think you've talked about The Dirty Dozen before, but just kind of, you know, if you've seen the film, kind of curious what your thoughts are on them, and I don't know, I may have asked this before, maybe not, but maybe you could name maybe your top, you know, couple of war films. I know you were just, the episode I just got done listening, you're talking about The Big Red One and The Green Berets, two films I haven't seen for a very long time. So just kind of curious if you have any other favorites out there. With that, I'm loving what you're doing, the A to Z thing. I'm getting ready to listen to episode C, letter C. And, yeah, just keep it up. It's going to be a fun journey over the course of the next, year plus. With that, hopefully this message got to you in one piece. And sorry, I'm kind of distracted here. I've got a crazy driver in the middle of nowhere. Wouldn't you know this idiot driving on this lonely road here, two-lane highway. Okay. But keep up the good work, loving the show, and I'm going to try to tune into your ABC Darwin. I did not know you could listen to it online. That's pretty cool. I think that I'm going to try to do that. And with that, sir, take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Richard. Yeah, they're good recommendations all. Dirty Dozen I do like. I kind of like the getting the band together kind of aspect of the Dirty Dozen. My favourite war films, that's a really difficult one. I do like the kind of big ones, The Great Escape. I'm very fond of. And I think films like 49th Parallel, which I've talked about, anything I've talked about in the podcast that's a war film, particularly this, I like films that were filmed during World War II a lot, particularly the ones filmed in England that were about the war, Went the Day Well and all those sort of things. I kind of think that there's an immediacy to those ones that were made in the middle of those circumstances. And even films like the 1940 Thief of Baghdad, which were filmed during the war and partly interrupted by the war, are very interesting films as well. It's that there's a kind of immediacy there that really does work for it, possibly in the same way that something like The Hurt Locker works now, because it's something that is occurring now. I think that you can't underestimate that, but I do like those big ensemble ones. I like things like The Guns of Navarone, because they're kind of epic stories and epic adventures, and very well told, and the ensemble cast are there. A lot of the actors in these films that were made in the 50s and 60s did have something to do with World War II as well. It's a bit like people get pissed off with Mel Brooks for making fun of Hitler, but he's got a right to. He fought the guy. And those kind of things. So they're my favourite ones. But, yeah, I do like Dirty Dozen. I haven't seen All Quiet on the Western Front for a very, very long time, and I've got to have to catch up with it at some stage. But thanks for the recommendation. Thanks for listening as well. Hope you enjoyed the Star Trek convention down there. And I hope that the idiots on the roads don't mess you up too much. So I'll get on to the next one. The next voicemail is another one from Dr. Zom, because I put out the last podcast earlier. I recorded it earlier, didn't get a chance to get Zom's last voicemail in, but here's the one relating to this podcast.
Radio Cinema. This is a heavily medicated Dr. Zom. Radio Cinema. Just wanted to call in with a bit of a review of a movie that I watched before I went on vacation. That movie is Four for Texas. Paleo Cinema, this movie is starring Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Anita Ekberg, Ursula Andress, Charles Bronson, Iron Mike Mazurki, for all you former pro wrestling fans, but for all you wrestling fans, Iron Mike Mazurki, who was in, I believe the term is called, a shitload of movies throughout his career. This movie also has Victor Buono in it, and liked him a lot in this big rotund man. I've seen in a lot of movies a very flatulent man in this movie, as he belches quite a bit. He may have set a record for belching in this movie. This movie also, I believe, without looking it up, is the last appearance of the Three Stooges in movies. Produced and directed by Robert Aldrich. It's just a good time. Charles Bronson is in great shape. He's thin and fit and is a badass gunslinger, heel heavy, if you will, baby. And this movie, just a lot of fun, has some great settings, great costumes, two very, very beautiful women from the past of cinema, Ekberg and Andress. Frank and Dino playing off each other, just having a hell of a good time. You can tell everybody in this movie seems to be having a real good time. Iron Mike Mazurki, who I spoke of before, I was listening to when I went on vacation, an interview with Jeff Walton, who worked for the wrestling promotion in California back in the day. And he spoke of, said that a lot of wrestlers wanted to work the California promotion just simply because a lot of the old-time wrestlers who worked the California promotion got involved in movies as either stuntmen or
you know, in TV or in movies as actors. Iron Mike Mazurki, Freddie Blassie, and another one that was kind of along the same lines as Iron Mike Mazurki was Judo Jean LaBelle. If you see a picture of Jean LaBelle or look up his filmography, he was in a ton of stuff, a ton of stuff. A guy was a legit tough guy who was a judo black belt and who was notorious for putting people to sleep with his sleeper hold, choke hold, sleeper hold. Actually, did a little number on one Steven Seagal on the set of one of Steven Seagal's movies, as Seagal was bragging, very arrogant, bragging and being really rough with a lot of the stuntmen and kind of, you know, hurting him in some of the scenes in one of his early movies. So they called in Jean LaBelle. Jean LaBelle told Seagal that he could put him to sleep, and Seagal said, "There's no way. I know, you know, I know my stuff, and there's nobody that can choke me out. There's nobody that can put me to sleep." And he was dumb enough to let LaBelle put the sleeper on him, and out went Steven Seagal. Rumor has it, or legend has it, that he actually pissed his pants, which it's kind of common, I guess, or supposedly common, when people get put unconscious. But I've seen LaBelle in action and doing when he does his gimmick where he actually does cut off the carotid artery on both sides of the neck of people and puts them out. I mean, you go out, and when you do that, sometimes he'll have a cup of water sitting off to the side, and when you're laying there unconscious and making all kinds of gurgling, snoring-like noises, he pours the cup of water on your crotch. So I'm pretty sure that's probably what happened to Steven Seagal. But anyway, that's a couple of guys that were former pro wrestlers. Another one, Lenny Montana, who played Luca Brasi in The Godfather, was another big-time professional wrestler back in the day. And H.B. Haggerty, Hard-Boiled Haggerty, was another one that that got involved in movies, that was just in a lot of movies. And if you see any of these guys, as soon as you see their face, you'll probably know who they are, because they've been in a lot of movies. But anyway, I'm rambling on because I got off on a tangent about the old wrestlers. Have spoken to the Frost Giant before about Jim Barnett's World Championship Wrestling that ran in Australia for quite a bit with Larry O'Day, Mario Milano, Maniac, Mark Lewin, Big Bad John, Abdul the Butcher, Tiger Jit Singh. A lot of guys over there. Good times. Those times are past. But just like in the cinema, they live on forever on YouTube, on film. And this is Dr. Zom saying it's good to be back home from my vacation, even though my dog just farted on the couch as we speak. Dr. Zom saying Dr. Zom out.
Thanks for that, Zom. Good recommendations all. Yeah, the wrestling digression really did get there. And yeah, I was a fan of the wrestling when I was a kid, and I used to watch it at 12 o'clock on Saturdays on Channel 9, and then they'd go from there to showing Gladiator movies and shit like that on Saturday afternoons afterwards. And they kind of mixed up in my mind, so I kept having these mental images of Mario Milano with the trident fighting Woody Strode. But anyway, thanks for the nostalgia stuff, and keep it up. I'm really, really looking forward to having a chat with you on Skype and doing something for the podcast. And we're going to pick a couple of films that are very much not action films, and kind of groove on 1960s wonderfulness while we do so. And I'm also looking forward to the other four people I've got lined up for doing the podcast as well. I kind of went a bit mad when I was at Continuum and locked in a few people to be guests on the show. But anyway, that's about it for this time. This one's run about an hour and 24 minutes so far. Thank you very much for everybody that contributed voicemails and emails this time around, and for everybody for all of your support over the time we've been doing this so far and into the future. So it's really great. I'm still enjoying it, still enjoying watching movies and getting passionate about them. Of the two films today, definitely see Eyes Without a Face. The Iger Sanction, I can take or leave. But anyway, on with real life. Take care of yourselves, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with the F's of the Alphabet Project. I haven't even figured out what I'm going to talk about, which movies yet. I'm going to do my research and go into them and groove from there. But anyway, take care of yourselves, and I'll be back very, very not too long from now.
Fucking Catalina Wine Mixer.
It's the fucking Catalina Wine Mixer.
It's the fucking Catalina Wine Mixer.